Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Rosemary Thornton. Before I bring her on, a couple of announcements. Coming March 11th, 12th, and 13th, we've got Forbidden Knowledge News Con. You're going to have 8 amazing presenters. It's going to be online with a Rockfin Premium membership, and that means you can get the entire conference for only $10. Check out our website to see all the presenters and what they'll be presenting. And all you have to do is sign up through that Rockfin link in the description, and you're going to get access to not only the conference, but all our premium content and all the content from every creator on Rockfin. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. And check out the podcast that we feature on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. That's on our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Those links are all in the description. We live in an incredible universe surrounded by mystery and beauty, and many of us have questions about our past, present, and future. October Hallam is an intuitive medium with over 20 years' experience. She has assisted people with discovering their path by understanding their past and connected the living to their loved ones who have made the transition. She is currently offering readings through Skype, Zoom, FaceTime, phone, and in person. You can reach her at theancientgift222@gmail.com or give her a call. That's 409-502-5950 to schedule your reading now. Today, I want to welcome back to the show Rosemary Thornton. For 20 years, she enjoyed a national reputation as an expert on old houses. She's the author of 9 books, and she has been featured on everything from PBS History Detectives to BBC Radio. In 2016, her husband committed suicide, and 2 years later, she was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. After a routine medical procedure, she then bled to death. And in the afterlife, she was told that if she agreed to return to Earth, she'd be restored to wholeness. And subsequently, medical tests affirmed that not only had the disease disappeared, but she was also healed of the crippling grief. Rosemary, welcome back. How are you?
I'm well. How about you?
I'm great. It's great to have you back on. It's been a while. I think it's been over a year since we spoke. And
Very possible.
Yeah. Every time we speak, though, our world is a completely different place. things have been definitely surreal in my world, to say the least, in many aspects. How has the past couple of years been treating you with everything that's been happening? And did you think that society could have been changed so drastically in the time that it has?
Oh, a pretty big question. Questions. An integral part of my story is my husband ended his life, and that thus began my foray into a whole new world. And that is my gravest concern with the COVID stuff. Putting people in isolation, not a good plan. I just think we got to back up and look at the bigger picture. You know, who hasn't seen a human face for a while? You know, who's getting so lonely that their mind is turning against them? So yeah, I am pretty concerned about what we'll learn from this.
We're just talking about how much the suicide rates have increased, along with all the other diseases, not including, of course, COVID, but have increased by ridiculous percentage because people have been home and depressed and getting sick and, you know, not being able to live their life in the normal way. And you're absolutely right.
I am very concerned because, I mean, my story is that, you know, I'm getting tangled up in a cord, the problem of Zoom.
Uh-oh.
Okay, there we go. I'm trying to make this thing hide.
It's attacking you.
I'm trying to be so professional. I've got this cord coming after me. So that is, my story starts with my husband ending his life, used a gun, pretty horrible and ugly. I'm a sensitive soul, been a writer forever. And it really wrecked my life. And when I read about somebody who's lost somebody else to suicide, I just often burst into tears because I know it's going to take the person closest to the one who's gone years, if not decades. You know, one thing for my story after my husband did this, I think it was the next day. I think it was a couple of days later. I had lost the ability to swallow. So I had had no water, no drinks, no food, no nourishment of any kind for 48 hours. And my daughter hauled me off to a urgent care place, you know, where they could see me right away. And the doctor came into the room and he saw me and my daughter. And he said, "So, ladies, what's the problem?" And my daughter said her husband killed himself and she can't take in anything. And we need something that will help her just swallow some water. And the doctor, true story, he did this, had the chart in one hand. He reeled back, threw himself against the wall. And he said, "Oh my God, oh my God, the same thing happened to my Aunt Bertha and she was never right in the head again." And that's, you know, so with the COVID and the isolation, we got to find a balance. We have got to figure out solutions because will this come again? Could be. Well, we got to figure out how to not create more suicide survivors, which is how we're known.
Oh,
although
yeah.
It's kind of a goofy term, not goofy, but not exactly precise term. People who have survived the death of a loved one to suicide, that's what we're called. So yeah, let's stop this. Let's figure out how to preserve mental health. Physical health, yay, great, that's important. But you know what? If somebody said, "I'll give you good physical health or I'll give you good mental health," you can only pick one. I'd take a good mental health because I believe a good mental health, you can preserve. I don't know. And my own story, again, my own story is a cautionary tale. And this happens so much. So my husband did this, lost my mind, societal leper. He was a fancy attorney. I was an author. I'd written 9 books, had a nice career. We were a power couple. You know, we had everything. And I went from that to being addicted to prescription drugs and drinking too much and slept in my car a few nights. And I mean, I was pretty jacked up. And then I was diagnosed with cancer 29 months later. You can't have a mental breakdown. You can't lose everything on this earth, including friends and social connections, which is what happened to me, and not have an effect on your physical well-being. So we have got to stop acting like Western medicine is everything. We have got to stop acting like physical health is secondary, is the most important thing when it's not. I mean, yeah. One of the things I did after my cancer diagnosis, I mean, stage 2, you know, hey, let's begin the chemo and the radiation. I was supposed to start daily radiation and once a week chemo. And one of the things I did, I went online and I looked up stories primarily on online videos of people who had been healed of cancer through nothing more than changing the way they thought, whether it was prayer, meditation, and I swear I'm not going down a bunny trail here, but have you ever heard of Dr. Bernie Siegel, Love, Medicine, and Miracles was his book.
Have
you ever heard
yes.
of that book?
Yes.
He was an oncologist and he has this amazing story. And the story he tells is, as an oncologist, he observed that he sent lots of people home and said, "You know what? I'm sorry, you got 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, whatever, but this disease, this insidious disease will take your life." So he sent them home. And then 5 years later, he sees them out at the grocery store, walk in the park or something. He says, "Hey, what happened?" And he found out there was a current theme between all these stories. And the current theme was when these people found out that they had 6 months to live or whatever the medical diagnosis was, they said, "You know what? I hate this job. I'm not going to stay in this job." And they quit their job. They realigned their life. They either married their woman or they divorced their woman. You know, they yes. made big changes. The disease gave them the permission to say, "Why am I doing this thing I hate?" So the disease gave him permission. And he found that the people who said, "Screw it, I'm quitting, I'm divorcing, I'm marrying," whatever was needful, they did. And then the cancer went into remission or went away. So that's what I'm saying. We're so, and I don't mean to be off on a diatribe, but we're so focused in Western medicine on treating the body. We need to start looking about what's going on in their head and their heart. Do they have social connections? Do they have somebody to get them to the hospital? Do they have a friend? Do they have somebody living in their home to see if they fall and slip? You know, do they have somebody in their life that cares about them? And with COVID, you know, I went on a roommate service. I tried to find a roommate for a time. I went on a roommate service and it sounded great, but nobody else was doing it. So the number of people, you know, because, "Oh, I'm so scared of this, I'm scared of that," but we just got to find a way to put people together. And even now, you know, I'd be grateful to have that part of my life resolved too. So yes, COVID, big deal, world changed. Man, we got to figure out how to protect people's mental health.
Well, yeah,
and it's
that's
not
the thing.
By isolation.
It's disgusting. The pharmaceutical and the whole medical complex in general is a huge letdown. They don't focus on the root causes. They focus on Band-Aid fixes. They want to make money off of your illness. It's all about, you know, people dying, and this is what they are making their profits off of. The whole medical industry is profiting off of people's death, and it's even worse now. It's more evident now, and you're right. If people could realize that the body has profound capabilities to heal itself, and the powers that we can have by tapping into not only, you know, the powers of those healings, but many other aspects that could allow our body to kind of grasp on to those abilities, and of course the medical industry would never look at that. They yelp and scream and run away from that stuff. So they do.
And that book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, changed my life. I mean, I read that years and years and years ago, but boy, that's a pretty interesting point. And yes, it doesn't work for everybody. And that's the scary thing. In fact, when I came back from heaven, I had, you know, I'm here because I had an NDE. I had to go back to my oncologist and say, look, I'm not going to be needing that chemo. Because actually what was starting, they had a chemotherapy tutorial where I was supposed to go to this class on how to manage chemo and its side effects. So I was supposed to start that like in days. And then I was supposed to start cisplatin, which is a very powerful chemo drug, and do that once a week. And then the radiation was going to be daily, 5 days a week. So I go to my oncologist after my near death, and I don't like the term near death, man. I was not near dead. I have medical verification that my heart stopped. I was dead. This wasn't a gray area. So, and I have no doubt I was dead based on the experiences I had. But in heaven, one of the things I was told is if you agree to come back, you'll be healed. And the thing was, the angels didn't say you'll be healed of stage 2 cancer. They didn't say you'll be healed of grief. They didn't say you'll be healed of this and that. They said you'll be restored to wholeness. And I was. And I didn't really think to negotiate the details. But when I came back from this thing, I was in hospital for a few days. I had an awareness the cancer was gone. And I had an appointment a few days later after I got out of the hospital. Actually, it's 2 weeks later to go see the oncologist again. I said, hey, I don't think we need to do the chemo or the radiation. The angels told me I was healed in heaven. Well, he was not pleased. He was not pleased at all.
Yeah.
And he, in fact, gave me a very graphic and gory description of how I would die now. And he said, it'd take about 2 years, and I'll spare you the details. But it went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And it ended with, and you will drown in your own fluids. And he said he had been called to the bedside of many people like me who had decided to forego scientifically proven treatment in order to embrace these ideas about faith healing. So it was pretty scary because, I mean, I didn't want to die like that, you know, and I had just come back from being dead. Been there, done that. And so it didn't make sense that this would be a divine plan, that I'd get yanked back from this having been dead for more than 10 minutes, by the way. And ultimately, I found another oncologist, which took some work. And even she was pretty frightened. I mean, she kind of went on and on and on about, you know, we really need to be sure of this. And I did have another biopsy. But in that, it took several weeks between having come out of the hospital from my near-death experience, or temporary death, as I prefer to call it, and then having this second surgery to determine that there was not any cancer left, second surgical biopsy. And in that time, there were times I got frightened. Did I hear those angels right? I'm betting my life on this heavenly encounter. I'm betting my life on having heard this correctly, literally. And one of the things I did, that's when I went to the online videos, and I looked up every online video I could find of somebody healed of cancer. And boy, there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them. So people, and the predominant thing was people found peace. They changed the way they thought. It wasn't just, okay, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. I can beat this. I'm going to be okay. It was like, honestly, I guess the thing that came to me was the story of the Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, for the three guys in the fiery furnace from the Bible. And the three guys are not, they were not worshiping the God, they were not worshiping the way the king thought they should worship. So the furnace was heated 7 times hotter. They're marched into the furnace. And before they go into the furnace, they say one more prayer and they say, God, it'd be lovely to be rescued. That's kind of their last prayer before they're marched into the furnace that's so hot that even the attendant shoving them in dies from the blast of heat. But the three guys say, save us, God, we rely on you to save us. But if not, it's okay, because our life is in your hands. And I felt like that was the key to healing. And I would say, God, I hope I'm healed of this cancer. But if not, I'm in your care. You know, and that's, I think that's the big deal is when we say, I can't control the outcome, but all I can control is how I think. And I'm just going to say, you know what? I don't want to go into this fiery furnace. I don't want to be burned up, but if not, and you know, that story, I mean, that's a famous bedtime story. I've heard it called Meshach, Shadrach, and to bed we go. But the three Hebrew guys come out of that, and the Bible says, without the smell of smoke upon them. And I really felt like I came out of my own experience having died, gone to heaven, promised healing when I came back, literally without the smell of smoke upon me. I felt like every vestige of the horror of my husband's suicide was gone, all of it. And the word that came to me when the angels talked to me about being healed in heaven, they said, the muck of the earth has been removed from you. And I love that word. I even had to look it up. I thought muck just meant gooey, icky stuff. Muck is excrement. You know, muck is basically excrement mixed with mud. It's just nasty, nasty stuff. Mm. And I was told that everything that happened, because my last conversation with my husband before he pulled the trigger was an ugly argument. He hung up on me. And I had no idea that was going to be the last time I ever heard his beautiful voice. It was. So I was told by the angels that that whole thing had been encapsulated. And that's such a cool word because my background is in architectural history. And that's what you do with potential contaminants. You encapsulate them. You don't try to remove them. Sometimes in their removal, you create more dust and debris. And I was told by the angels that this whole thing had been encapsulated. In other words, I can't say it never happened. It happened. It was a thing. It was a horrible thing. But it couldn't hurt me anymore. And that was transformative. So in listening to these YouTube videos about these people who had been healed of cancer and other life-threatening illnesses, one, there was a peace in their eyes. They're changed. You know, there's a new word people use, and it's spiritually transformative experiences. You don't have to die to be healed. You know, you just have to change the way you see your place in the universe. You have to change how you think about everything. And one thing I had always suspected before my own experience was that the decision to stay or go is made on a spiritual level. When I was at that, I came to a closed door in my own near-death experience, and I wanted to go. In fact, moving through this experience, one of my predominant thoughts was, 59 years old, and I got early release for good behavior. I've not had a fun time on earth, you know? First a divorce after 24 years of marriage, and then my second marriage ends with a gunshot wound to the head, self-imposed, and me losing everything. I just wanted out. And every night before I went to sleep, I said three prayers. One was, God, heal me or let me die. Spare me the life of you. After his death, I had had recurring nightmares where I saw him put that gun in his mouth again and again and again and again and again. And it's like I lived through that death, I don't know, 200 times. So I asked God, spare me the life of you. And because I didn't want to see myself break down for 2 years and lose my mind. And then my third prayer was no more hard decisions. I had severe decision fatigue to a point that I had purchased shortly after his death. I purchased 12 white polo shirts and 4 pairs of jeans. I couldn't even face what to wear for the day. So every morning I could open my closet, pull out a white polo shirt, didn't even have to choose a color, and then a pair of jeans, and I was done. So those YouTube videos that I watched after my NDE helped me affirm that, yeah, spiritual healing is a thing. And in fact, what I said earlier about the decision to stay or go is made on a spiritual level. You know, when I died, I was a mess. I had stage 2 cancer, had been diagnosed by 2 doctors, and it was apparent upon visual exam. In fact, the second doctor said it had advanced to a point where the flesh was distorted. This was cervical cancer. And to go from that to the second surgical biopsy, where the oncologist literally ran out of the surgical suite to the waiting room where my friend was and said, she's right. There's not one cell there. She said, in fact, her flesh is so pink and pretty and perfect. Were it not for all these medical tests, I wouldn't believe she ever had cancer. And that's spiritual healing. That's healing on a level that's with our spiritual DNA. And you know, the other thing that was healed, I mean, I died, was gone for 10 minutes. But if you ask me, my time in heaven, I was there for hours, maybe days. I don't know. I was there an awfully long time.
Now, Rose,
what
I
is
wanna,
time?
I want to talk about that experience because it's very profound. I know we discussed it last time, but this is such a profound experience, and it really, I think, brings people a little bit closer to an understanding of what these possibilities are for life after death. Now, kind of bring us through the series of events after, you know, your husband commits suicide, you're diagnosed with cancer, and then as it, you know, gets closer to the time where you actually pass away, what are these series of events leading up to actually you passing away?
That's a good question. I know we jumped in with COVID and meandered around a bit.
Oh, no, that's good. That's good.
Gosh, I was married to him for 10 years, thought he was the love of my life. He and I would go to bed early at night so we could read books together. We would read our books, and then we would read books to each other. And we were both a couple of nerds. You know, we loved science. We loved math. We loved reading. We loved literature. So I knew I had found somebody that was just right. So this was beyond shocking that he did this. I loved him with my whole heart. You know, after my divorce from husband one, I didn't think I'd ever love again. And then I found two, and it was wonderful. So he killed himself in April 2016. I suffered the torments of the damned. Friends disappeared. You know, what's really interesting is all the people that were those fancy, important people in my life. As you know, we were part of the in crowd. And all the fancy, important people went away. And who came into the fray was the people who had not so great jobs and not so great incomes, and the people who'd worked their whole life to try to keep body and soul together. Those were the people who stepped into the fray and said, actually one woman in particular, her name was Tracy, had found out that I'd been sweeping in my car occasionally. My car was actually very comfortable. I really liked that car. And honestly, I was like a wounded animal. I couldn't get comfortable. Couldn't go home. Gosh, I can't go home. Didn't want to be in another house. I felt like if I moved into another house, it was an affirmation he was really dead. Couldn't face that. So sweeping in the car was actually very comfortable for me. And my friend found out I was doing that. And she said, "You're not sweeping in that car again." She said, "You come home with me." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not." And she said, she used to say, "I love having a famous author as a friend." I wasn't famous, but I'd written a few books and had some good publicity. And I said, "Tracy, the woman that you knew is dead. She died with that bullet to my husband's head." And she said, "Look, I understand you're passing through some deep waters, but come home with me." So I did. Stayed with her for 4 months. And then somebody else, after 4 months, somebody else moved into my, actually, he and I shared a home, and he became my caregiver. And I had a dog. I couldn't even take care of my dog. So this dear friend who was living in the home with me took care of the dog. And I had lost a tremendous amount of weight, probably 40 pounds or more. And I looked mighty thin. And then a neighbor saw me. I had rented a house in a small town, and the neighbor came by one day and introduced herself. And she said, she asked me about how I came to move into this little rental house. And I told her my husband shot himself, and she started crying. And I thought, well, what an idiot I am. This nice neighbor shows up and I can't help it. Blah, blah, blah. Here's what happened to me. And she burst into tears. And then she told me her brother had killed himself. And she said, "People don't understand suicide. They think it's another death. It's not." She said, "Our family's never going to be right again." And then that dear woman came by every night with a tray of food for me. And I mean, she had looked at me. She said, "You look pretty gaunt. Are you eating?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And so she, every night for, oh, I don't know, about a month, she brought a tray of food over for me to eat. And I mean, you know, it touched me deeply. And so I started noticing these people around me wanted me to stay alive. And I would tell them, "Look, I'm beyond economical repair. Stop putting your effort into me. I'm not worth saving. I'm sure of it." And yet they saw something in me that I couldn't even see in myself. So thus I lived for 29 months trying to hang on and hold on. And then I had some very disturbing symptoms, very unnatural symptoms. I knew something was wrong. I went to a doctor, gynecologist, and they diagnosed squamous cell cancer. Went to another doctor. They did some tests. And then it was the gynecological oncologist that actually was the one who said the flesh was distorted. And he's the one who did the biopsy, did a cervical biopsy. And I had never been anesthetized. I had never had any anesthetic. I'd been very healthy, and I relied on God my whole life for healing. And so something went bad or wrong. And when I woke up from that, I was bleeding profusely. And they said, "Oh, once you get home and lie down, you'll feel just fine." So they sent me home bleeding profusely. And at home, I realized I was dying. So it's funny. It was kind of funny. I got a macabre sense of humor. So take that with a grain of salt. But I had put myself into the shower, realizing that I was bleeding out. And I thought, you know, in the early days, I had read a Bible, or somebody had read me a Bible verse that said, God will show you the way out. And I think it's 1 Corinthians something. And I remember thinking, I'm bleeding to death. This is my way out. This is my escape pod. And I will not have done this to myself. So I thought about that real hard. And then I thought, you know what? This man who'd taken such good care of me and his sister were out in that living room. I thought, is that fair for them to come into this shower and find me splayed on the floor, bled out? No. So I went to a little ER, little standalone ER, not affiliated with not connected to a hospital. They made some more mistakes. I was right before I left, lost consciousness. I grabbed the hand of the nurse that was to my left. I'm on a gurney now in this ER. And I said, promise me you're not going to let me die. And she was very dear, very sweet, very motherly. And she looked right at me and she said, oh, honey, you're not going to die. We have many solutions for this. I was like, okay, she seems very authoritative. She seems to know of what she speaks. Oops. And they packed me like a Christmas goose and left the room. Little did they know, that packing did not stop the bleeding. It just stopped the mess. And I bled to death. So I lost consciousness soon after they left the room. In fact, they gave me a shot of Dilaudid, I swear. That's a morphine derivative. And all that did was grease the skids to the afterlife. You know, I just kind of sped things up. Let's see if we can move this along. Wow. Anyway, I popped out of my body like toast out of a toaster. And I knew instantly what had happened. And first words out of my mouth in this new experience was, my heart has stopped. How do I know that? I don't know, but that's right. And then one of my other early thoughts, and I mean, all this kind of happened at once, was you're dying. I thought, well, all my life I'd wonder what it'd be like to be dying. And I thought, actually, you're not dying, you're dead. And you know, as a longtime editor and writer, I thought, that's pretty darn funny. Here I am going on to my reward and I'm correcting my tense. And it cracked me up and I laughed out loud. And I mean, I've lived alone a long time, and so I talked to myself and I can hear my voice, and I heard my giggle, and my giggle was the same as it's always been. And I remember thinking, I don't have breath sounds. I don't think I have vocal cords. I don't know about ears, but I sure can hear myself. And I thought, this is great. And I felt so good and happy. You know, seriously, if I could condense this to three sentences, dying is like waking up from an intense dream. And that whole 59 years of my life seemed like it was just an intense dream and so unimportant. That's what struck me. The experience I was having as I floated further and further away from my body, that was real. That was important. That was profound. And it just, boy, talk about a reset. And I remember thinking, everything I am went with me, even my funny giggle, even my goofball sense of humor. And I remember thinking my whole life, I've wondered, what would I look like, the neurotic writer? What would I look like without any fears or worries or woes? And I thought, this is it. That's what I left behind on that gurney. It's all the negative stuff, all the sad stuff, all the anxiety. And I thought, this is just so great. And it went on and on. And one of the things that happened early in the experience was, and I'm floating away in blackness, perfect, silky, comforty, velvety blackness. And it was so comforting. Peace. It was perfect peace, just perfect, perfect, perfect peace. And I realized I was being accompanied, that a massive spiritual being had joined me. And he, she, was much taller and slightly to my left and slightly behind me. And I turned my head to the left to look over my shoulder to see who had joined me. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. I have a head. I'm turning my head to my left to look over my shoulder. And I realized, really, everything we are, you know, even this construct goes with us. And I asked, and who are you? Because I'm like, this is great. Somebody's joined me. And the answer was immediate. The answer was, you, Rosemary, you are the image and likeness. I'm the original. I was like, whoa, that's 1 Genesis 26. Spent my whole life reading that, wondering, what does it mean to be made the image and likeness of God? And it didn't just come with words. It came with an infusion of knowledge, which was just so cool. And I still think about that multiple times a day. I still think about this experience, specifically that part. So on and on it went. I mean, on and on. I swear it felt like hours. And then I came to a door. After the blackness, somehow I ended up in a white room, and I don't remember the transition, but I was in this beautiful white room, and little droplets, like a fog, was all around, a heavy fog, and it was flowing. Yeah, that's a better word to use, flowing. These droplets were flowing all around me. They were encircling me. They were swirling. They were moving. They weren't just falling like fog does. We're not just existing, not just homeostasis. It was moving. And I tried to focus on an individual droplet, which I know that sounds crazy. Imagine being in the fog and trying to focus on a droplet. And I was now with an angel or spiritual being, not the first one, but I was with an individual spiritual being. And I said, why can't I focus on this droplet? And the answer was, your spiritual eyes have not acclimated to this new environment. But what you're seeing, all these little droplets, are particles of light. And it was likened to a spiritual car wash, that we can't go to heaven with a muck of earth imprinted on our soul. And some people think they've died of a disease process. Some people think a disease process is so heavily imprinted on their consciousness that it's part of their identity. And in my case, it was probably mental illness and sadness and grief and mourning, and all that was part of me. So I was told that we pass through this white room and get cleansed. As a friend said, leave your muddy boots at the door. I love that. So I got to this door and the door was closed, and I had read NDEs my whole life. I knew what that door meant. I knew that door was a point of no return. I couldn't wait to get to that door. That door, this white room with the mist falling all around, was probably 15 to 20 feet in length to get to that door. And who knows? I guess, 20, I don't know. But the door was closed. And I remember thinking, that door is supposed to be open, you know, but I don't care. Everybody out of my way. I'm doing the door. And as I got to the door, I remember thinking I'm going to have to push through it or use my hand or something. And I asked the angel that was with me, I said, is this the divine will for my life, that a medical mistake takes me out? And even before I could finish that sentence, all I could get to was, is this divine? And the angel said, no, it's not. But whatever you decide, you go with all God's love and mercy and grace and care and blessings. And I thought, I'll take that deal. Don't need to tell me twice. I'll do it. And I put my right hand up to push through that door. And I had a vision. And to call it a vision isn't fair. It was like I was an invisible witness in a hospital supply room. And there was that nurse sitting on a metal stool at the center of the supply room, head in her hands, leaning forward, sobbing uncontrollably. And I am a witness to this. I am watching this. And she says through tears, I promised that woman I was not going to let her die. And I lost her. And I thought, okay, she appeared to be about my age. She's an RN. She's lost a few patients. She can manage. I need to go. Do not ask me to go back to Earth, to all that suffering, to all that sadness, to all of it. You know, a thing is, even in this experience, I remembered my husband's suicide. And I remember thinking, I'm clear. I'm out. And I did not do to my children what my husband did. I spared them that. This was not by my own hand. In fact, I even sought out medical care rather than collapsing in that shower. So I thought, all right, I'm sorry that RN is suffering, but I got to go. And then I wasn't witnessing it. I felt her grief and pain at having lost a patient. And I recognized it as that deep, guilt-ridden, agonal pain. And I thought, that's what I felt over my husband, so much sadness and regret. I thought, if I can spare one person that much grief, I have to go back. Boy, I was not a happy girl at that point. But I put my right hand back down at my side, and the last words I said in heaven, I said, it's going to ruin that nurse's day if I die. And in a split second, I was back in my body in that on that gurney in that little ER. And from there was now I had a lot of attention. I had my friend who had taken or who had been there with me. He said they even called in the receptionist to work on me. So I was whisked away by ambulance to a trauma center, and I was there for several days. You know, it's really cool. The next morning, I got the real doctor. You know, I got the doctor that's been doing this a while instead of the kid who had a stethoscope with play school written on the side. And the real doctor at the real hospital, he said, you've had a heart attack. I said, not me. Ride my bike, walk, eat lots of green veggies. Not me. He said, no, no, it was you. He said, we've done blood work this morning. And he said, your enzymes were elevated last night. Uh-oh, I need to stop that. I'm sorry.
No worries.
And he said that it was not underlying heart disease, but my heart had stopped due to the blood loss. And I was not surprised, because when that first words I heard, your heart has stopped, it was right. And there was a lot of expectation. In fact, they thought my heart muscle was damaged from the lack of blood. I mean, having a heart, waiting out at age 59, it turns out, is not real good for the body. And yet when I came back, they did a lot of tests on me in every way. And all the tests, I mean, it's so funny. The doctor would come in and say, Mrs. Thornton, you're a very lucky woman. There's no heart damage. You know, Mrs. Thornton, you're a very lucky woman. There's no damage to your internal organs. Mrs. Thornton, you're very lucky. It seems there's no consequences from bleeding to death. So, and then it did take another doctor and some time to prove that the cancer was completely gone. But I came back feeling very different. I came back feeling like a new person. And after I came back from this, I started selling off all my worldly possessions. I mean, all of them. Donated research materials to a local library, local college library. And then I packed up, I sold my car, I sold my house. one of my friends thought I was getting ready to off myself because I was selling off everything. But I moved 1,000 miles due west to start a new life. It was a big deal. And it was exactly the right thing to do.
Now, how long was it from the time that you basically woke up till you found out that you were cancer-free? How long did that take?
Well, when I woke up from this, well, you know what? I've been asked a lot of questions. I don't think I've ever been asked that. That's a really good question. Really, I mean that. I used to be a reporter. I know how to interview people. I don't know how to interview myself. As soon as I woke up in that little ER, because there was a lot of activity, and, you know, as soon as I wake up, I mean, I've been gone more than 10 minutes. The thing is, when you bleed to death, they can't even do CPR. So theoretically, my brain had been without any oxygen for more than 10 minutes, and I should have been mush. But the first thing the nurse does is get in my face and, what is your name? What year is it? Where are you? I think as soon as I came back, I had an awareness. I just knew it was over. I knew it was all over. And, you know, I had such a clarity about that until that appointment 2 weeks later with the oncologist, who went on and on and on about, this stuff does not go away like that. And he put mentally ill on my medical chart, by the way, because I believed I was healed in heaven. So, yeah, and that's pretty strong.
Yeah.
So I think it was instantaneous. But yet, you know what? So funny is after I met with that oncologist, the fear and the doubt started creeping in. What if he was right? What if I was mentally ill? What if I just had a hallucination about hearing that? You know, not about going to heaven, because I know I died. I have medical proof that I did, not to mention the mental proof. I mean, I have no doubt about any of that. But I thought, well, what if it's better? What if it's not gone? I mean, I really got myself tangled up over that. And then a friend, actually the friend who'd been my caretaker, he said, you heard this from the angels. How can you doubt them? I mean, you came back after being dead for more than 10 minutes with no brain damage, no heart damage. In fact, not only was there no damage, but I had old problems. I had a busted shoulder. I had a busted right knee. They were healed. I had suffered with pain from that busted shoulder for 15 years, and it was perfect. My right knee, I had been to multiple doctors, and they said, well, you busted it up when I had had an accident. It was all gone. High-frequency hearing loss was healed. I asked God about the eyes, but that's another story. I came back a completely different person. So after hearing this oncologist go on and on about how I would die, I suddenly got frightened again, kind of fell back down, rolled back down to the valley again. And my friend said, look, either you believe this whole thing or you don't, but you can't piecemeal it. You can't say, okay, I believe I was healed of the emotional trauma, but not the disease process. I believe that I can come back after bleeding to death, a 59-year-old woman, but not this. He said, you can't piecemeal it. And I thought, he's right. He's absolutely right. So I thought, I got to believe in something. And, you know, before this, I had been studying the biggest cancer study groups and cancer doctors and cancer care centers and all this crap. And I thought, I always love the saying, whatever you magnify gets bigger. I thought, I'm magnifying the disease. I need to magnify the blessings. So that's when I started looking up every story I could find of people healed of disease. And what I did is on online videos, I found every story I could of somebody telling their own story about how they were healed of cancer by prayer or meditation or leaning on God or something. I found every single story that I could, and I wrote their name on a piece of paper. And one was, oh my goodness, there were many of them. One was Dodie Osteen, who had been healed of stage 4 cancer. Just by going home and saying, I'm not doing this. oh no, I'm not doing this. So I wrote down these names on a piece of paper. And after I had a long list of names of people who've been healed, because you know what, if something can happen for one person, it can happen for everybody, which is why I'm out in the world telling my story. So after I had this long list of names, every morning I would look at that long list of names of people who've been healed of cancer and put their story out in the world. And I said, one day, Rosemary Thornton's going to be on that list. You know, this is where I'm putting my energy. This is what I'm going to focus on. This is what I'm going to magnify, is spiritual healing. And I knew one day my name would be on that list of people. And I couldn't let, you know, Frank, what's his name? Dr. Larry Dawsey wrote a book called, well, he's written a bunch of them, but one is Be Careful What You Pray For. And he talks about medical hexing in that book. And he said, as a doctor, he knew many, many, many people who died on schedule. When they're told you'll be dead in 90 days, they were dead on the 93rd day. When they said the next heartbeat will be your last, they went home terrified. And he talked about medical hexing. And I thought, that's what that oncologist did. It didn't mean to. His intentions were good. But that was a medical hex, saying, what are you thinking, saying you were healed in heaven? This is cancer. Do you understand that I'm the specialist and you're the one that came to me? Do you understand how horrible this is going to be as this progresses? Do you understand how big these tumors are going to get? I mean, that's just medical hexing. And I don't mean to criticize. I really don't. But Dawsey's right.
Yeah,
we got to be
absolutely
careful
right.
What we say about ourselves.
And
so how long was it? I would say it was instantaneous.
Well, how long did it take for the diagnosis to come through that you're cancer-free?
That was 8 weeks later.
8 weeks.
And the reason is, it turns out after you have been, I went to this new oncologist and she seemed very open-minded and very sweet and very capable, very competent. But I went to her and I'm like, I was healed in heaven, but I need to be sure, you know, for friends, for family, for me, I just want to be sure. Can we just do another super, super duper quick biopsy? And she said, wait, you bled to death from a cervical biopsy? I said, yeah. That's not the story. The story that I was like, healed in heaven. She said, how long did it take you to bleed to death? How did, can you tell? So she was more interested in that story. And you know, what's funny is she wouldn't do that second surgery without 2 units of blood on in the room. You know, she was so frightened that I would bleed to death again. But yes, it took 8 weeks. And part of it was, I said, can't you do it sooner? And she said, Rosemary, you just bled to death from cancer. She said, we're not going to do this right tomorrow. And yet, you know, there was an expectation it would take 2 to 3 months after this. When I was discharged from the hospital after dying, there was an expectation. Oh, that's a sentence, isn't it? When I was discharged from the hospital after my death, there was an expectation that it would take 2 to 3 months for my blood to recover, for my body to recover sufficient blood. And they did blood work at day 12, and my numbers were textbook perfect. And I remember the doctor looked at those numbers and she said, "This is impossible. We've got the wrong. Somebody's made a mistake." And I said, "No, I'm walking again. I'm riding my bike slowly, but I'm back on my bike again." And she said, no, this isn't possible. And I said, yeah, it is. So that was my first proof that this was something wonderful had happened.
That's
and then, but yeah, it was about 8 weeks. But it's funny, the medical people, I'm like, I'm healed. It's all great. She says, wait, you died from the cervical biopsy?
Yeah.
Yes. And then she did, oh my goodness, it turned out to a much bigger surgery, the second one, because she took little bits of pieces and stuff from many parts of my body because she said, I have to be sure there's not one cell left. And ultimately, that's what she said, is there was not one cell. And not only did she do biopsies in the surgery room, she had other attendants there doing biopsies. And then she sent stuff off for biopsy. I mean, she was very thorough.
That's incredible. Now, whenever I've interviewed many cancer survivors and people who have basically done self-healing for their cancer, and it seems that some of the main contributing factors to even get this disease is stress, grief, anger, sadness, and in experiencing those emotions in a perpetual state. And I myself, I had a horrible job. I mean, the job was great, but I hated it. I mean, I did not enjoy going, you know, work for this corporate institution and doing what I was doing, kind of, you know, not being honest with people every day to make my sales. And I was doing the job for years, and it took a major toll on my health. And I can see just, you know, from waking up and going to a job you hate every day could cause that much stress. Imagine what a loved one's suicide or something of that nature would do to a person, and not being able to deal with those emotions. So I think that that it's very incredible that people can, if they get rid of these contributing factors, that kind of opens the door for healing in other different ways, right?
I think that's a factor, but I do think we also have to be careful not to layer guilt on people who are going through this, to say, you know, you're stinking thinking brought this on. There's also, I mean, some people just have better health, you know. Some people come from families that have been ravaged from the disease, and some people come from families that have never had the disease. And I guess I'm just very, I do agree with what you say. I think if my husband had died of old age, if he died of a heart attack, I don't think I ever would have had this experience. But I also think it's, I know for me, a lot of people say, the number one question I get asked is, how come you lived and my girlfriend, brother, sister, husband, friend died? I don't know. That's hypothetical. I know that, like, Jesus healed the blind man, and the blind man was asked, who was this guy? What did he do to you? And the man says, look, I don't know. What I know is I was blind, and he touched me, and now I can see. That's what I know. And so I try to stay within that framework. I was pretty twisted and messed up. And the other thing I have met, you know, it's funny. I hired somebody to do some work to my house. And they sat down with me, and they asked about the scope of the work. And I could see they weren't feeling well. And I said, are you okay? And they said, well, my son hung himself 2 years ago. And I was just diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And she said, the pain meds keep the pain at bay, but I won't be here long. And, you know, the thing is, she was okay with that. And that's okay. We all have our own path. And my nightly prayer had been, God, either heal me or let me go. And upon this diagnosis, one of my first thoughts was, God, I said, let me die. I guess I should have been more specific, like quickly, you know, not from some drawn out disease process, just let me go. And yet, honestly, looking back on it, I got both. You know, I was allowed to die, and I got healed. I got brought back. And I tell you, not a day in my life goes by that I don't think about this experience and wonder if I made the right choice in coming back. And I did write a book. I guess I should mention that. People harped and harped and harped on me to write a book. And I said, look, I've written 9 books. We're not doing this. My books are on historic. You want me to write a book about an old house? Got it. Can do it. But I'm not writing about something as deeply personal as having a complete mental breakdown and then all the rest of this stuff. But ultimately, I decided I'm a writer. I used to be a newspaper reporter. I know a little something about paying attention to my environment. I thought, what if the reason I came back is to share it with others? And it'd be so much easier not to share it. You know, it'd be so much easier to just go live my life, live on what I got and live a simple life and all that. But I thought, I don't know that that's what I'm supposed to do. So honestly, the decision to write the book was a very difficult one. And it took me 3 years and finally finished. Boy.
Yeah,
well, Remembering the Light, How Dying Saved My Life. That's the title.
Yeah, and it's a good thing you did. This story is very profound, and I think it helps people gain an understanding of this type of thing. Now, whenever you came back from that time to now, how has your understanding of the afterlife, angels, God, Source, has it changed or developed or grown in any way?
That's a great question. I mean that really is.
Thank you.
Because, you know, that's really the story. The story isn't that this chick on the East Coast was healed of cancer. The story is, how is this reproducible? How can people apply this in their own lives? That's the story. That's why I wrote a book. Yes, every day I think about this. And somebody in my neighborhood where I was living, I ran into a friend. She said, yeah, you're pretty well known in your neighborhood. And I said, really? I've only lived there a year. How is it I'm well known? And she said, well, I ran into this woman, and she said, oh yes, her. She's a lady who talks about death all the time. And I was like, oh my God. If that's the takeaway, the message is getting lost.
Yeah.
So I do have to be more careful about with whom I share it. I think about it a lot. I think about being the image and likeness. I think about there being an original. I think about the angels and that they are always with us. You know, sometimes we see them and sometimes we don't, but they're always with us. I think about that. The thing about writing this book, honestly, the biggest thing I fear is the humiliation. I mean, I put my life out there for everybody to read about. I'm an intensely private person, but I figure a person has an experience like this, they ought to tell a few people. So yes, it's changed how I think about the afterlife. Honestly, the biggest problem, not the biggest, one of my concerns is I don't want to say, take me now. I've seen where I'm going. Take me now. Because I do believe we're here on a spiritual contract. And I believe if we violate that spiritual contract, I personally believe we get sent back to start over from day zero, you know, crying in the bassinet at the hospital. I think if we violate the spiritual contract, the only person we're hurting is ourselves, and I think we are setting ourselves back.
That's
So it
interesting.
has changed everything.
I was just about to ask you your thoughts on reincarnation, if that's a possibility or one of the options, maybe if after you experience that bridge.
Well, I don't know what I feel about reincarnation. I think God's pretty creative. And isn't it Carl Sagan that said there were billions and billions of galaxies? I hope we get sent back to another place, and I hope we get to keep our memory. What's the point of having your memory banks wiped clean? I don't get that. Seems like a waste. I think God's too good to believe in wasted effort. But I do believe that in terms of suicide, I think my husband and I had an ongoing argument. He was an agnostic, and I was, of course, a Christian. And we had an ongoing argument, and he would say, you know, when you die, this is just an organic body. It's lights out the end. And I said, oh, no. Life is eternal. When we die, I'm not sure where we go or what we do, but I know we go on. Soul is a lot. There's a lot of energy in a human soul, and energy cannot be destroyed. Maybe it can be changed and moved, but you can't destroy energy. I know the second he ended his life, I know with everything within me that he stood beside that chair in spiritual form and said, well, crap, she was right. I know it. I know it. I know it. I know it. And you know, I was so angry at him for so long. And after coming back from this, I was able to say, from now on, I send you love and light and healing. I hope you're doing okay. And that's that way, that was a big transformation in and of itself.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what are your thoughts on the different realms of or different planes that are possible after death, or these astral planes? Do you think that there is lower realms that for those that may be in a position or a different type of emotional state whenever they die, or in higher realms for different types of people?
I do believe that. I mean, we talk about vibrational energy, and I guess that's kind of become a new agey thing. But it's true. In life, we attract the people that are most like us. And since coming back from this, I run into these random people in random places, and suddenly we have a connection and we become friends and we enjoy each other's company. And it's so different than before. So vibrational levels or vibrational energy, there's something to that, and I don't know really how to quantify it or explain it. And yes, it makes sense to me that when we pass, when we leave this plane, it's more of the same. We're going to connect with the people that we have. I don't know that we resonate with, I guess, is a word. And I do believe that there are consequences for our actions here on Earth. I do, and I think suicide. You know, one of my fears in writing this book, I didn't want to make heaven sound too great because I don't, people should not end their lives. You know, there's like that Bible verse, God will show you a way out. I mean, I guess I'm proof that even the darkest, most hopeless circumstances, there's a way out. And you know, a lot of people say, do I have to die to have peace? No, but you sure got to shift the way you're thinking about stuff. And that's what dying did for me. It enabled me to shift from, why did he do this? I thought he loved me. I was a terrible wife. To, I loved. I loved. Doesn't matter what that object of that love was. I loved. And that's one of the things the angels told me is that love is like a river of light that flows through us. And we tend to think we have to have a human to love. But we can love everybody. We can love God. We can love the sacrifice of the apostles. We can just love. It's love that heals us. And so I was able to stop saying I loved him so much and just saying I loved so much. And that was so liberating. Oh my gosh, it was life-changing. And one of my questions for the angels is, where is he now? Like you're saying, different realms. I do believe in that. I said, where is he now? And the angels said, pretty bluntly, they said, none of your business. And I said, wait, what? And they said, you assigned yourself as a spiritual guardian. We are responsible for our own souls, our own progress, our own growth. You were not his spiritual guardian. And they did say he's with us. And that was frankly a very satisfying answer too. So when I think of where is he now, what's he experiencing, what's he going through, I think none of my business. You know, the Bible says we're to work out our own salvation. His salvation isn't my business. So I learned a lot, and I learned how to reframe the questions. I didn't learn, the angels told me. And right. That's why I wrote the book. When people get stuck in grief, it's hard to get out of it.
And I like how you said this last time that were you glad to be back here? No, hell no. But you realize that you have to make the best of the experience, and there's a purpose for it.
There is, and maybe my purpose is to write this book. I don't know. Writing is hard. People say, I want to write a book. If you say you want to write a book, you're doing it wrong. I think, I don't know. Writing is tough. But yes, I'm not sure why I'm back. I'm not. And I try to be a blessing some way to people every day. And, you know, sometimes I'm just this great little light, little blessing of flowers and hope and goodness. And other days I'm like, you know, I yelled at that clerk. And it was not her fault. And who am I, you know, saying, I am so full of light and love. So, yes, even in this human condition, I make some pretty egregious mistakes on a daily basis.
Yeah.
That's part of the human condition.
Yep. That's what I was just about to say. Now, Rosemary, thank you so much for coming on. That was fantastic as usual. When can we expect the book?
The book is out. Book is at Amazon.
Ah,
yes, and I have a website, temporarydeath.com, because I take umbrage at near death. I wasn't near death, man. I was over there having a great time. So yes, my website is temporarydeath.com. The book is Remembering the Light, How Dying Saved My Life, and it's up at Amazon, and it's 3 years of work and blood, sweat, and tears.
Perfect.
And dying.
That's great. Well, I will have all those links in the description. Like I said, this was fantastic. I love that we can get this information out to the audience, and I would also love to have you back on in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose. We will be talking again soon. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. Talk again tomorrow.